This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street, or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today. Greetings, I am Barry. This is The Voice Within for another week. Do you know how many Mondays you have left in life? You get 4,000 on average. And while the bad news is that you're totally going to kick the bucket, the good news is there's still time to live before you die. Learn how your mortality can motivate you to make the most of your precious time above the ground. Time's ticking. Jodie Wellman is a leading authority on living lives worth living. As a speaker and facilitator, she helps her clients live squander-free lives while they're lucky enough to still be above ground, while cleverly beginning with the big end in mind. She named her business 4,000 Mondays because it shines the light on the finite number of weeks we have to live like we mean it. Jodie holds a Master of Applied Positive Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania, where she is also an assistant instructor. As a certified coach with 25 years of corporate leadership experience, she helps executives, teams, and high-performance workers well and live even better. This talk was a text talk.
Hello, I'm Jodie Wellman, and I have 1,924 Mondays left to live. I'm dying. And you're dying. And we're all dying of the same terminal illness called life. Call me crazy, but I feel like this is excellent news. Because remembering that we will die is the secret to a well-lived life. Allow me to explain. There's an old Latin phrase called memento mori that translates to remember we must die. And I want us to do just that. Remember that we are totally temporary, but not in a morbid kind of way, because that's no fun. I'm thinking more of a let's wake up and stop taking life for granted kind of way. A year after he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, Steve Jobs said, "Death is very likely the single best invention of life. It is life's change agent. Memento mori can act as the spark plugs we need, especially in the midst of a global pandemic, to snap out of autopilot and fully participate in regret-free lives." In my research, and through thousands of hours of coaching people, I found three questions that help us stop taking life for granted, that help us live like we mean it. Question number one. Do you know how many Mondays you have left to live? Our Mondays highlight whether we're in a groove with life or a rut, right? As Ellen Glasgow says, the only difference between a rut and a grave are the dimensions. With an average life expectancy of 80 years, we get roughly 4,000 Mondays. And whether you have 2,500 to go or only 25, how do you want the rest of your thousands or hundreds or just dozens of weeks left to actually be? Yeah, okay, you might be wondering why we're getting all granular by quantifying our life countdown timers. Researchers call this temporal scarcity, that rare or temporary things are believed to possess greater value. So framing an event like our lives with an expiry date makes it that much more valuable and precious. You know, the idea of living life more fully just isn't as motivating without the shadow of death showing up to highlight all that we have to lose. Life becomes valued to the extent we recognize its impermanence. I know a thing or two about taking life for granted. I squandered 10 years of my life to eating disorders that robbed me of aliveness. I let my fears of inadequacy, of not enoughness, and my desire to control an uncontrollable world get the best of me. So I alternatingly starved and purged a decade of my life away. We all have ways of coping and numbing, right? And they can be healthy until they're not. Until our strategies, like drinking a little too much with dinner night after night, or endlessly doom scrolling through social media, or zoning out for hours on end in front of the TV. These are all slippery slopes that disengage us from the lives we could be living. I can't get the time back that I squandered, but I now see how precious life is, how finite it is, how it's our choice to make the most of the time we're lucky to be above ground. This is why I do the work I do. I'm making up for lost time, and I desperately want us to live squander-free lives. Knowing I have 1,924 weeks left to live, if I play my cards right, well, that sparks an intense desire to do this life justice and get to the end without a whiff of regret. Reminding myself of my inevitable, no way out alive, and maybe even imminent death, well, that snaps me to attention. It shines a spotlight on the life I'm living, and it kind of makes me wonder if it's worth dying for. Death motivates me to live. But don't just take my word for it. There's a reason why people who have had brushes with death, like through illnesses or close-call car accidents, falls off roofs, they experience what psychologists call the roar of awakening, the wake-up call of death. They have an outrageous appreciation for their lives. They have a clarity about what really matters, and a clarity about the trivial things that really don't matter anymore. One of my clients from Chicago, Christia, was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was just 37. She beat it twice and emerged through the rubble with this crystal clarity about leaving her big cheese corporate gig to start her own business. She was laser focused on doing the work she wanted and ditching the work that no longer lit her up. Research consistently shows that people who have faced death don't waste time attacking the problem of finding meaning and fulfillment in life. They get down to the business of living with urgency, like Christia. And that's what we're after, right? Is the wake-up call that underscores the value of life, but without the drama of a near-death experience. Memento mori can wake us up to life. So much of what we've been talking about is avoiding regrets, avoiding getting to the end and feeling like we pursued the wrong things, instead of the goals that might have given us a shot at more joy. And this leads us to question number two. If for some bizarre reason you got word that you were going to bite the biscuit tonight, what would be in your book of coulda, shoulda, wouldas? Might you have just a page? A chapter? Several volumes? I ask this question around the globe, and the answers are invariably similar. People say they'll regret not going for that big job in New York, not running that half marathon, not seeing the sunset in Santorini, not fixing their relationship with their mother, not asking Debbie Sue to the prom. Mark Twain was spot on when he said, "We're more likely to regret the things we didn't do than the things we did do." And research tells us that regrets can be powerfully effective if we tap into them in advance and then edit our lives along the way to prevent them. I left a soul-stabbing job not long after my mom died with volumes of unfulfilled dreams in her 50s precisely because I didn't want to wonder about my own paths not taken. This is why I do the work I do. We don't have to live the version of our lives that's riddled with regrets in the making. With the Grim Reaper in mind, we can take action on the lives we really want to be living. And we can cross the potential regrets off one by one before life calls it curtains on us. So far, we've talked about how much time you have left, not nearly enough, and we've talked about how you don't want your life to be living in the land of regrets. Now let's explore how you can make the most of your precious existence with the help of positive psychology. Thanks to modern advancements, we have more years in our life than ever. But do we have more life in our years? We can't control how long we live, but we can control how well we live. Researchers make it clear there are two ways to look at well-being. So one is hedonic happiness, which involves feeling good, and the other is eudaimonic well-being, which involves doing good. And I propose we can deliberately widen and deepen our lives with these two branches of well-being. We make our lives wider when we stuff them with vitality, expanding the breadth of the fun, the hedonic pleasure, all the experiences life has to offer. Okay, think of this as a continuum. The ranges from being in a Netflix coma, like bored and in permanent autopilot mode, all the way over to getting an A+ for showing up and fully participating in life with enthusiasm. This right here is the liveliest version of your life. And you might widen your life by jumping out of planes, playing the trombone, gardening, exploring new neighborhoods, baking baklava, hiking through Zion. The list goes on. My client, Christia, will always be famous to me for booking spontaneous trips to places like Bali to reignite her feelings of aliveness. So what can you do to widen your life with vitality? And to be clear, though, this isn't about living like an Instagrammable, just-for-show kind of life. It's about staving off the boredom that comes from feeling stuck in the dull and monotonous versions that our lives can slip into. Right? We know when we're asleep at the switch of life, but we often lack the momentum to turn that switch back on. It seems as though our fear of death is rivaled only by our fear of living. Embarking upon life wholeheartedly with anticipation and excitement as though it was an adventure, that all-out approach to life can make up for its crappy finitude with intensity and passion. But research tells us that living wider isn't always enough. So we make our lives deeper when we infuse them with meaning. And the meaning spectrum ranges from feeling empty and purposeless to feeling like our existences matter beyond the roller coasters and cotton candy at Disneyland. This eudaimonic dimension of well-being includes doing what we do best, so using our talents, helping, giving, making meaningful connections with other people, getting in touch with something bigger than ourselves. So what can you do to deepen your life with more meaning without feeling the pressure to quit your day job and spend 70 hours a week saving the sea turtles? Not that there's anything wrong with the sea turtles. They're quite cute. Existential psychologists say that the persistent anticipation of death is what puts a fine point on the purpose of our lives. That sense of urgency created from memento mori can be what crystallizes the meaning in our lives. Okay, so marrying these two axes together of life widening vitality and life deepening meaning creates a framework, a way to gauge your aliveness or deadness. And here we are at question number 3. Where would you plot yourself today? Where do you want to be? My research shows a whopping 40% of people feel meaningfully bored. So okay on meaning, but woefully short on joie de vivre. And this was true even before the pandemic. Only 8% of people feel astonishingly alive. So let's let death work its magic as the intentional reminder that life's too fleeting to kick the bucket feeling bored and empty. The client I've been telling you about, Christia, sadly passed away in December at the age of 42. In our last session together, I didn't even know her cancer had returned. I asked her where she'd plot herself on this framework, and she didn't have to think twice. She felt astonishingly alive. She made her life wide and deep, just not long. The secret is out. We're all living on borrowed time. Not a single one of us is getting out of here alive. And the question is whether we're stuck in autopilot or whether we're living lives we'd be proud to look back on from our eventual deathbeds. Aliveness is relative, and there isn't a right or wrong way or amount to live. Just as long as you've committed to living in vivid color, with width and depth. So how do you want the rest of your life to be? Only you know what it might take to feel less like an impressively functioning zombie and more like someone living a life you love. It starts with one small thing, one small choice that has the potential to alter your remaining moments and weeks and years. You might choose to stave off a potential regret to prevent a coulda, shoulda, woulda. You might choose to punch up the pleasure with a single vitality-inducing event that can widen your life even by an inch. Or you might choose a small way to make some meaning in your life, to deepen your life with meaning, even by a smidgen. Above all, I urge you to take me up on Memento Mori and regularly count your Mondays. You might get more than 4,000, but the morbid truth is you might not even get that many. Let your mortality motivate you to live like you mean it, as though you've been warned that you will not live forever. Don't postpone your existence. The bad news is you're totally dying. The good news is there is still time to live before you die. And here's a final bonus question. How can death bring you back to life? Thank you.
We all must plan our hopes together, or we'll have no more future at all. Time waits for nobody. And down the line, I know that sounds unkind, but it seems to me we've not listened to or spoken about it at all. The fact that time is running out for us all. Time waits for nobody. We've all got our backs against the wall.
greetings. I am Akash, and I bid you welcome to the high courts of the universe. Please don't be alarmed. Though we are of a different world, a different dimension, we are yet one with you. The transport beam has brought you exactly 2,300,065 light years from the Earth to the Andromeda Galaxy. You have been summoned as the defense in the forthcoming trial. The Time Lord versus the people of the planet Earth. And you will, of course, be expected to show us why the Earth should be allowed to continue its existence. I know you have many questions, but fear not, all will be answered in time. But now it is time for the trial to begin. Let the judges be summoned.
Well, that makes you think, doesn't it? Now, I never thought about 4,000 Mondays. I'm running out a bit myself, but there you are. Now, that was Freddie Mercury, and this is a part of the soundtrack of the film, or the stage show, called Time. And we're running out of time. This is in the story of the musical. A rock group gets taken to another dimension, as you just heard there, in Andromeda, to stand trial for why the Earth should be allowed to carry on, because the way we're stuffing it up at the moment. Perhaps it's not all doom and gloom. Patricia Coda Robles is now going to tell us about the violet flame of a thousand suns. The people who are coming through to replace us.
Last week, we were told by the Company of Heaven that throughout the month of September in 2022, lightworkers are being called to join with the Company of Heaven, and they will guide us through various individual and collective activities of light. The divine intent of this request is for all of us to help the I Am presence of every one of the holy innocents to lift their head above the effluvia of their own earthly experiences, so that they can awaken much more quickly. With our assistance, these young people will be able to hear the intuitive inner guidance of their I Am presence more clearly, which is by far the most powerful and the most effective way of awakening them and reminding them of their purpose and reason for being on Earth during this critical time. The beings of light are affirming that the number of people on the planet who are awakening and deliberately adding to the light of the world every single day is legion. This has prepared all life on Earth in ways that will now allow Saint Germain and his fifth dimensional violet flame archangels to raise the intensity of the violet flame of God's infinite perfection to frequencies that are beyond anything humanity has previously experienced. We are being told by the Company of Heaven that this will greatly accelerate the transfiguration of humanity's third-dimensional carbon-based cells into fifth-dimensional crystalline-based solar light cells. Saint Germain has given us a powerful activity of light that has been building in momentum in the realms of cause. Today, as we participate in this activity once again, Saint Germain and his fifth dimensional violet flame archangels will exponentially intensify the power and might of this sacred fire. If you have the heart call to be the open door for this gift of light on behalf of humanity, the elemental kingdom, and Mother Earth, please join with me now. And we begin. I am invoking the fifth dimensional crystalline solar violet flame of God's infinite perfection with the power and might of 1,000 suns. I am my I am presence, and I am one with the I am presence of all of humanity. As one voice, one breath, one heartbeat, and one energy, vibration, and consciousness of pure divine love, we invoke the most intensified frequencies of this fifth dimensional violet flame that cosmic law will allow. Beloved Saint Germain, and your legions of fifth dimensional violet flame archangels, we ask that you blaze the brand new frequencies of this violet flame with the power and might of 1,000 suns in, through, and around every thought, feeling, word, action, memory, and belief that humanity has ever expressed in any time frame or dimension, both known and unknown, that is reflecting anything less than the love-based patterns of heaven on earth. Transmute this energy, cause, core, effect, record, and memory back into its original perfection, and seal it in an invincible force field of God's comprehensive divine love. Now we invoke the Goddess of Liberty, who takes her strategic position at the cardinal point to the north. The Goddess of Divine Justice, who takes her position at the cardinal point to the east. The Goddess of Freedom, who takes her position at the cardinal point to the south. And the Goddess of Victory, who takes her position at the cardinal point to the west. Joining these powerful beings of light are the Goddess of Glory, who takes her position in the center of the earth, and the Goddess of Oneness, who takes her position high in the atmosphere above the earth. Joining her in the atmosphere of earth are the Silent Watchers, the Mighty Guardians, and all of the beings of light who are assisting humanity at this time from the heavenly realms, as we empower the awakening of the holy innocence. Every person's I Am presence now opens the stargate of our heart, and instantly we become the open door for this unfathomable frequency of the fifth dimensional violet flame. This exquisite sacred fire pulsates through our heart flame and blazes in, through, and around all inharmonious actions, all lower human consciousness, and all obstructions of the light that any person, place, condition, or thing has ever placed on the pathway of life's perfection. Through the divine power of liberty, justice, freedom, victory, glory, and oneness, the violet flame instantaneously transmutes this discordant energy back into light, now and forever. With the influx of this brand new frequency of the fifth dimensional violet flame, the silent watchers over every country, state, city, town, village, and hamlet on the planet reach out their loving arms and raise up a limitless number of lightworkers in every location who are willing to participate in the faithful use of this new fifth-dimensional crystalline solar frequency of the violet flame of God's infinite perfection. Each of these lightworkers understands the full importance of this sacred gift now being offered by our Father, Mother, God to help free the holy innocents from all interference and human miscreations. The conscious use of this sacred fire from the heart of God will cause to be established within every one of these places great force fields of this fifth dimensional violet flame, which will continually bathe every person in each vicinity. Now, through the clarion call of humanity's collective I Am presence, this awe-inspiring new frequency of the fifth dimensional violet flame begins to expand and expand. Beloved Saint Germain and your legions of fifth dimensional violet flame archangels, we ask that you blaze this violet flame with the power and might of 1,000 suns through the following patterns and paradigms that are surfacing now to be transfigured into the heart base patterns for the new earth. Beloved ones, blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through the thoughts, feelings, words, actions, memories, and beliefs of every man, woman, and child evolving on earth until every person individually acknowledges and accepts the divinity within all life and every expression made by humanity is a healing benediction for every particle and wave of life on earth. Blaze the flame of 1,000 suns through all incoming babies, the children, teenagers, and young adults, and their parents and guardians, until all youth are raised up in energy, vibration, and consciousness to carry out the directives of their I Am presence. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all youth centers and activities, all schools, colleges, and universities, all leaders, teachers, instructors, and professors in every line of endeavor, until the flame of illumined truth and enlightenment is manifest and eternally sustained within the heart and mind of every person. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all religious and spiritual teachings, so that divine love, truth, tolerance, oneness, and universal brotherhood and sisterhood will become a manifest reality. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all doctors, nurses, healers, hospitals, insurance companies, pharmaceutical conglomerates, and every institution associated with healing of any kind, until divine mercy, compassion, and healing are tangible realities for every evolving soul. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all banking and financial institutions, all economic systems, all money and the people associated with monetary interactions of any kind, until every person on earth is openly demonstrating true integrity, honesty, generosity, fairness, abundance, and the God supply of all good things. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all places of incarceration and all employed there, through every correctional institution and every judge, jury, and court of law, until divine justice is manifest and eternally sustained. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all of the governments of the world and every person, place, condition, and thing associated with the governments of the world at national, state, and local levels. Intensify this violet flame until every government is focusing on oneness, reverence for all life, and co-creating the highest good for all concerned in every single instance. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through all space activities throughout the world, until every nation unites in cooperative service, so that God's will may be manifest with our sisters and brothers throughout the universe. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through the physical, etheric, mental, and emotional bodies of humanity, until all disease and human miscreation, its cause and core, is dissolved and transmuted into purity, vibrant health, eternal youth, and physical perfection. Blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns through the food and water industries, and through all of the food and water used for human consumption, until every particle of food and every molecule of water is filled with light. Empower this elemental substance to raise the vibratory action of humanity's physical, etheric, mental, and emotional bodies, until physical perfection becomes a sustained manifest reality for every human being, the elemental kingdom, and Mother Earth. Now, beloved ones, blaze the violet flame of 1,000 suns in, through, and around every remaining electron of precious life energy, until the immaculate concept of the new earth is tangibly manifest in all of her resplendent glory. We accept that this activity of light is being God victoriously accomplished right here and right now, even as we call. We also accept and know that this new fifth dimensional violet flame will intensify daily and hourly, moment by moment, with every elevated holy breath we take, until this sweet earth and all her life have completed our ascension into the fifth dimensional realms of crystalline solar light on the new earth. And so it is. Beloved I am, beloved I am, beloved I am. Dear one, this week, focus on this new frequency of the fifth dimensional violet flame, knowing that your divine intention is helping the holy innocents in powerful ways to awaken much more quickly. God bless you.
What can you say about yesterday? And a mind still free. A long time ago is different from today. Today the world is dying. Tomorrow will be the same.
will tomorrow be the same? I have no idea who that is, but in 1999, just before the change to the 2000 millennium, a lot of schools in Hamilton got together and produced a lot of music. And this is from one track from an album called Music for the Millennium. It was put together by the schools. So it's relevant, but it's 22 years old now. But it's the same sort of stuff, eh?
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. That your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
The original Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Teach Your Children Well. They're the ones that are going to look after this planet for us, I hope. Now, we talk a lot about healing ourselves, but is there any sort of scientific proof about it? This is Lisa Rankin, who is a medical doctor.
Can the mind really heal the body? And if so, is there any scientific evidence to convince skeptical physicians like me? These are the questions that fueled the last few years of my research. And what I discovered is that the scientific community, the medical establishment, has been proving for over 50 years that the mind can heal the body. We call it the placebo effect. And we've been trying to outsmart it for decades. The placebo effect is a thorn in the side of the medical establishment. It's an inconvenient truth that gets in between trying to bring new treatments, new surgeries into the medical establishment. So it's a problem, supposedly. But I actually think this is really good news. The placebo effect is excellent news because it's concrete evidence that the body holds within it innate self-repair mechanisms that can make unthinkable things happen to the body. So if you find this surprising, if you have a hard time believing that the body can heal itself, you need look no further than the Spontaneous Remission Project, a database compiled by the Institute of Noetic Sciences of over 3,500 case studies in the medical literature of patients who have gotten better from seemingly incurable illnesses. You think there's such a thing as an incurable illness? I swear, if you go look at this database, it'll blow your mind. Everything's in there. Stage 4 cancers that disappeared without treatment. HIV-positive patients that became HIV-negative. Heart disease, kidney failure, diabetes, high blood pressure, thyroid disease, autoimmune diseases, gone. A great example of this in the medical literature is a case study from 1957 of Mr. Wright, who had advanced lymphosarcoma. So things weren't going well for Mr. Wright. Time was really running out. He had tumors the size of oranges in his armpits, his neck, his chest, his abdomen. His liver and his spleen were enlarged, and his lungs were filling up with 2 quarts of milky fluid every day that had to be drained in order for him to breathe. But Mr. Wright wasn't giving up hope. He had heard about this wonder drug called crebiosin, and he was begging his doctor, "Come on, just give me some of that crebiosin, it's all going to be good." Now, unfortunately, the crebiosin was only available on a research protocol, and the protocol required that the doctor be able to make an assessment that says that this guy has at least 3 months to live. And his doctor, Dr. West, just couldn't do that. But Mr. Wright was tenacious, and he didn't give up. He kept badgering his doctor until finally his doctor was like, "Okay, fine, I'll give you the crebiosin." So he dosed him up on a Friday, not expecting that Mr. Wright would make it through the weekend. But to his utter shock, when Dr. West came in to do rounds on Monday, Mr. Wright was up walking around the wards, and his tumors had shrunk to half their original size. They had melted like snowballs on a hot stove, and 10 days after getting the crebiosin, they were gone. So Mr. Wright was up rocking and rolling, like praising crebiosin as the miracle drug he believed it to be, for 2 months, until the initial reports came out about crebiosin that said that it didn't really look like crebiosin was working so well. And Mr. Wright fell into a deep depression, and his cancer came back. So this time, Dr. West decided to get sneaky, and he told his patient that, "You know that crebiosin that you got? That was a tainted version, really not so good. But I got us some ultra-pure, highly concentrated crebiosin. This stuff's got it going on." He then injected Mr. Wright with nothing but distilled water. And once again, the tumors disappeared. The fluid in his lungs went away. Mr. Wright was up rocking and rolling for another 2 months. And then the American Medical Association blew it by publishing a nationwide study that proved definitively crebiosin was worthless. 2 days later, Mr. Wright, after hearing this news, died. Soon after that, I came across another study in the medical literature that was the stuff of fairy tales. 3 baby girls were born, delivered by a midwife on Friday the 13th in the Okefenokee Swamp near the Georgia-Florida border. And the midwife pronounced that these 3 babies born on such a fateful day were all hexed. The first, she said, would die before her 16th birthday. The second, before her 21st. The third, before her 23rd birthday. And as it turned out, the first girl died the day before her 16th birthday. The second died the day before her 21st birthday. And the third girl, who knew what had happened to the other two, got wind of that. On the day before her 23rd birthday, she showed up at the hospital hyperventilating, begging them to make sure she survived. She wound up dying that night. These 2 case studies are great examples from the medical literature of the placebo effect and its opposite, the nocebo effect. So Mr. Wright, when he got that distilled water and his tumors melted away, that's a great example of the placebo effect. When you get a seemingly inert treatment, and yet something is happening physiologically in the body such that disease goes away. The nocebo effect is the opposite. So the 3 hexed girls are an example of the nocebo effect, when the mind's belief that something bad is going to happen in the body then comes to manifest. So the scientific literature, the medical journals like the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association, these scientific journals are full of evidence that the placebo effect and the nocebo effect are incredibly powerful. We've known this since the 1950s, and we've seen countless case studies that show that in almost everything you study, if you give people a fake treatment, a sugar pill, a saline injection, or most effectively, a fake surgery, 18 to 80% of the time, people get better. And it's not just in their mind. That's what I thought in the beginning, like, oh, they're just feeling better, they're thinking better. But it's not. It's actually in their physiology. This is measurable. You can actually see what happens to the body. So, for example, patients getting placebos were found to have ulcers that healed, colons that became less inflamed, bronchi that dilated, warts that disappeared. Cells looked different under the microscope. It's provable. It's happening in the body, even though it's initiated by the mind. So when you look at these, some of the studies are just amazing. I love the Rogaine study. So, you know, you get a bunch of bald men, you give them placebos, they grow hair. The opposite is also true. So if you give people a placebo and you tell them it's chemotherapy, they vomit and they lose their hair. So this is really happening in the body. And the question that I had is it just the mind's positive belief that's making this happen? Not according to Harvard researcher Ted Kapchick. According to him, he thinks that the most essential part is actually the nurturing care of a healthcare provider, more so even than the mind's positive belief. That some of the studies actually say the doctor is the placebo, or can be. So Ted Kapchick wanted to study this, and he did a great study looking at patients that were getting placebos for an illness, for treatment of an illness, and he told them, you're getting a placebo. There's nothing in here, inert ingredients, nothing active. They still got better. Most likely, Kapchick postulated, because they felt tended, nurtured. They felt like they were doing something. They felt like somebody cared. So to say that you can heal yourself is sort of a misnomer. You know, the body can heal itself. The body has these innate natural self-repair mechanisms. But the scientific data proves that you need the tending, nurturing care of a healthcare provider of some sort, of a healer, to facilitate that process. It's not an easy process to go through alone. So it makes a big difference if somebody else is holding that positive belief with you. But the problem is, while the doctor can be the placebo, the doctor can also be the nocebo. So what patients need from us as healthcare providers, they need us to be forces of healing, not forces of fear or pessimism. So every time your doctor tells you you have an incurable illness, you're going to have to take that medication for the rest of your life. Or God forbid you get cancer and they say you've got a 5% 5-year survival rate. It's really no different than when that midwife told those three baby girls that they were hexed. It's a form of medical hexing that's so prevalent. As doctors, we think we're being realistic, you know? We're giving people the kind of information we think they need to know, but we actually can be harming them. Instead, we need to be more like Dr. West, you know, taking that distilled water. Really, Mr. Wright, I promise, this is going to do it for you. But do we have to count on our doctors to dupe us? You know, do we have to get fake surgeries and fake drugs and wind up in clinical trials? This is what led the next phase of my research. So in my last TEDx talk, I talked about a new wellness model that I developed called the Whole Health Cairn. And this came about as part of my research trying to find how else can we harness this mind's power that's clearly evidenced by the placebo effect and the nocebo effect. Can we do something without being in a clinical trial? And my hypothesis was that in order to heal ourselves, in order to be optimally healthy, we need more than just a good diet, a regular exercise program, getting enough sleep, taking your vitamins, following your doctor's orders. Those things are all great and critical and important. But I also came to believe that we need healthy relationships, a healthy professional life, a healthy creative life, a healthy spiritual life, a healthy sex life, a healthy financial life, a healthy environment. In essence, we need a healthy mind. So I wanted to try to prove this, and I went into the medical literature, and the copious data that I found proving that all of those things are essential really blew my mind. I compiled them all into my upcoming book, Mind Over Medicine, Scientific Proof You Can Heal Yourself. But I want to give you a few highlights about what this is all about. So you can see from the Whole Health Cairn that all of these facets are built upon a foundation stone that I call your inner pilot light. And for me, that's that essential, authentic part of you that knows what's true for you, that's willing to tell you the truth about maybe what's out of alignment in your life, what stones in your Whole Health Cairn might be out of balance. And as you see, I've put the body, physical health, on the top of the Whole Health Cairn because it's the most fragile, the most precarious, and the most easy to kind of fall out of balance if other things in your life aren't going so well. So what I found in the medical data is that relationships matter. People who have a strong social network have half the rate of heart disease compared to those who are lonely. married people are twice as likely to live long lives than unmarried people. In fact, curing your loneliness may be the most important measure of prevention you can enact upon your body, more so than quitting smoking or starting to exercise. Your spiritual life matters. Those who attend religious services live up to 14 years longer. Your professional life matters. You really can work yourself to death. In Japan, they call it karoshi, death by overwork. And people who survive, the survivors of those who die of karoshi can actually apply for workman's comp-like benefits in Japan. But it's not just Japan. It's actually happening even more in the United States. We just don't get benefits here. So they did one study, and they found that people who fail to take their vacation are actually a third more likely to get heart disease. Your attitude really matters. Happy people live 7 to 10 years longer than unhappy people. And optimists are 77% less likely to get heart disease than pessimists. So how does this happen? What's happening in the brain that's making the body change? This was what was fascinating to me. What I found is that the brain communicates with all the cells in the body via hormones and neurotransmitters. So for example, if you have a negative thought, belief, or feeling in the brain, your brain triggers this as a threat. Something's wrong. If you feel lonely or pessimistic, things are bad at work, you're in a toxic relationship, the amygdala says, threat, threat, threat. And it turns on the hypothalamus that talks to the pituitary gland, that communicates with the adrenal gland, and the adrenal gland starts spitting out stress hormones like cortisol, norepinephrine, epinephrine. It turns on what Walter Cannon at Harvard called the stress response that triggers the sympathetic nervous system and puts you into that fight or flight mode, you know, which is adaptive, it's protective if you're running away from a mountain lion, you know. But in everyday life, you're supposed to have that quick stress response if there's a threat, and then it's supposed to switch right off. This isn't what happens in our regular lives these days. But fortunately, there's a counterbalancing relaxation response that Herbert Benson at Harvard described. And when this comes about, the stress response turns off, the parasympathetic nervous system turns on, and healing hormones like oxytocin, dopamine, nitric oxide, endorphins fill the body and bathe every cell in the body. What I found the most amazing about this is that those natural self-repair mechanisms that we all have, they only flip on when the nervous system is relaxed. So when you're having stress responses, that all those natural self-repair mechanisms get flipped off. The body's too busy trying to fight or flee in order to heal itself. So when you think about this, you have to start to wonder, like, how can I possibly start to change the balance in my own body? So one study showed that on average, we have more than 50 stress responses per day. And if you're lonely or depressed or pessimistic or unhappy at work or in a miserable relationship, that number is going to be more than twice as many. Now, the relaxation response is what researchers think explains the placebo effect. So when you're going to get supposedly maybe a new wonder drug, you don't know whether you're getting the placebo or not, it triggers that relaxation response, that combination of the mind's positive belief and the nurturing care of a healthcare provider relaxes the nervous system. And then all those natural self-repair mechanisms can come into play. Fortunately, though, you don't have to be in a clinical trial to turn on your relaxation responses. There are lots of simple, pleasurable activities that turn on the relaxation responses, and these have been proven in the medical literature. So you can meditate. You can express yourself creatively. You can get a massage, do yoga or Tai Chi. You can go out with your friends. You can do work that you love. You can have sex. You can laugh. You can exercise. You can play with animals. So I ask you to consider the whole health care in your own life. Which stones in your whole health care might be out of balance? Each of these stones can be a factor for creating stress responses or relaxation responses. How might you turn on more relaxation responses in your body? And most importantly, what does your body need in order to heal? What prescription do you need to write for yourself? And are you going to be brave enough to take action on the truth of what your inner pilot light already knows? I believe our system, our healthcare system, is badly broken, and it's largely because we've lost respect for the body's ability to heal itself. The medical establishment has gotten arrogant. We've come to think that with all of our modern technology and all that we've learned in the past century, that we've mastered nature, and we find it repelling to think that maybe nature could be better than we are sometimes. And yet, spontaneous remissions from incurable diseases are proof that sometimes nature's just better than we are. It's a narcissistic wound for physicians. We don't know what to do with that. It makes us feel helpless and hopeless and useless. But fortunately, we're needed. The physician and all the other healthcare providers are absolutely essential to this process. We need to embrace this. And patients need to change their outlooks on this as well. It's not just doctors. We need patients to stop thinking that your body is not your business, taking your power and handing it over to other healthcare providers. Your body is your business, and your mind has tremendous power to communicate with your body such that your body can heal itself. So I once had a dream, and in my dream, I was standing there looking at these mountainsides full of millions of people that were standing shoulder to shoulder, and they were all facing due north, dressed in all these tribal garbs, beautiful colors, covering the mountainsides like a quilt. And there was a bright, streaming light on their face, and everyone was facing this light. And that's what I think of when I think of healthcare. I think of all of us standing up and facing the light. So please stand with me for a moment. It's going to take all of us. Just because things have gotten bad doesn't mean they can't get better. I believe that just like there are no incurable illnesses, there are no incurable systems. But it's going to take all of us needing to open our heart and open our minds and bring care back to healthcare. So please hold hands with your fellow neighbor and let's just set the intention right here that things are going to be different from now on, that we can start this grassroots effort, that it all starts with you. Be the love that you want to see in healthcare, and I believe miracles can happen. As we do this, you're releasing oxytocin, dopamine. You start to heal yourself. And as we do so, we can heal healthcare. Thank you.
This is what Bruce Lipton was talking about some years ago. If you fear it, you're likely to get it. This is Lisa again, and now she's talking about, are medicines killing us?
Is modern medicine killing you or saving you? The very idea that we should have to ask that kind of question is so upsetting to me as a doctor. I was called to medicine the way many are called to the priesthood, as a sort of spiritual calling. My whole goal is to help you heal, not to harm you. And yet, when you look at the causes of death, preventable medical error is the number three cause of death, according to the Center for Disease Control and the Institute of Medicine. And it's not just medical error. It's the whole nature of our pill-popping medical culture that's been adopted by patients and doctors alike. Now, we know, according to the Center for Disease Control, that 90% of doctors' visits are the result of stress. And yet, as a doctor, I wasn't taught to help you deal with your stress. I was programmed to believe that it was my job to medicate you or to operate on you so that you could go back to the status quo of your stressful life. And yet, I've started to rethink that in the research that I've been doing lately. And what I've come to realize is that as doctors, it is our job to help you address the fact that stress is one of the biggest killers among us. And that maybe instead of medicating you or operating you solely, maybe we need to help you address the issues that might be predisposing you to illness or exacerbating your illness, like the toxic relationships in your life or a soul-sucking job that's draining your life force. Or financial worries, or social isolation and loneliness, or a pessimistic worldview. All of these things have been scientifically proven to predispose you to illness. And yet, when was the last time your doctor suggested that? Our healthcare system is so broken because we are in the business of symptom relief, not symptom prevention. Dr. Andrew Weil says, we have a disease management system, not a healthcare system. And we're blind to this. We're sort of turning a blind eye to this, I think, because we think chronic stress is just an inevitable part of life. It's just how we have to live. And as doctors and patients, we are turning a blind eye to this because it's too hard to face. We don't want to realize what it would take in order to alleviate our stress, to predispose us to longer, healthier lives. So we've made this collective agreement that I won't talk about it and you won't talk about it. You know stress is bad for your health. As a doctor, I know how many of my patients are showing up in my office because of the stress in their lives, and yet we've sort of agreed not to talk about it. But I'm here to illuminate that for us, because the idea that medicine could be killing us is just anathema to me. I can't live with that, because I have a dream of a healed healthcare system, one in which we bring the best of modern medicine, everything that we've learned about pharmaceuticals and surgical interventions and such, and we marry it with what it means to be a true healer, what I was called to do as a doctor, where not only am I putting a Band-Aid on the symptoms that are the result of your stress, but I'm also putting a soul back in you. This soul medicine, I think, is so much of what we've lost in modern medicine today. I dream of being able to replace that, of reclaiming the heart of medicine, and of reminding you what it means to be a whole, healthy human being. This is essential because our current healthcare system just isn't working. We all know it, doctors and patients alike. Yeah, it's broken, people. This is breaking my heart, because when you look at the data, we spend more on healthcare than any other country in the world, and yet 32 countries have longer life expectancies than we do. Patient dissatisfaction is rising. 90% of hospital patients didn't even know the name of their doctor at the time of discharge. It's not just doctors, it's not just patients that are dissatisfied. Doctors are just as dissatisfied. 9 out of 10 doctors would not recommend becoming a doctor. And 70% of Americans take at least one prescription drug. 20% take 5 or more. So I want to show you something here. These pill bottles have a month's worth of medication in them. And I'm going to show you, there's approximately 500 of you here. I'm going to show you how much medication it takes to medicate all of you for just one day based on these statistics. Now, we've been trained in our system to think about medicine the way a doctor would think about a football player in a football game. You know, the football player gets injured, so we bring the injured football player out of the game and we fix the ankle and we set the bone or we inject the joint and we do everything we can to send the football player back out into the game. But what a lot of people aren't talking about is perhaps the best thing for the football player is to get the football player out of the game. Right? And yet, it's not just the doctor's fault. What do we do when the star football player says, "Doc, just do anything. Do anything you can to get me back in the game so we can win the Super Bowl"? That's what many of you as patients are doing. You are asking us as doctors to fill you with pills so that you can go back to the game of your stressful life. And I'm here because it's breaking my heart that we're having to do that. And I want to change the game. I want to suggest that maybe there's a different way of doing this. So I wrote a book called Mind Over Medicine, Scientific Proof That You Can Heal Yourself. And it's all about the scientific data that proves how stress affects our bodies. And this was really revolutionary to me as a doctor. I didn't know anything about this 4 or 5 years ago. And it was shocking to me to study the data. Because what I came to realize is that stress is not what we think stress is. You know, I think in this culture we have this concept that stress is like a badge of honor. I'm stressed, therefore I'm busy and worthy and important. But to the body, stress is very different. Stress is anything that triggers the amygdala in your brain to turn on what Walter Cannon at Harvard called the stress response, also known as the fight or flight response. So anything that turns on your fight or flight response puts you into the sympathetic nervous system and fills your body with cortisol and epinephrine and other very poisonous stress hormones. Now, this is good if you're getting chased by a tiger or if you're about to be in a car accident, because it helps to protect your life. But your amygdala doesn't know the difference between getting chased by a tiger and negative thoughts, beliefs, and feelings that originate in your mind that turn on those stress responses. Now, what I didn't realize, and this was my big aha, is that the nervous system has two operating systems. There's the fight or flight, stress response, sympathetic nervous system, and there's the parasympathetic nervous system, or what Herbert Benson at Harvard called the relaxation response. And this was my big epiphany. Your body is beautifully equipped with natural self-repair mechanisms. Your body knows how to fight cancer, how to prevent heart disease, how to fight off infection. It does this every day. But those natural self-repair mechanisms are deactivated every time your body's in stress response. Now, what is stress? Stress, as I said, is getting chased by a tiger. But stress is also social isolation and loneliness. Stress is selling your soul for a paycheck. Stress is a pessimistic worldview. Stress is fearful, anxious, worried thoughts. Stress is toxic relationships. Stress is money worries. Stress is knowing that you have a song within you that you have yet to sing. Stress is feeling out of touch with your life's purpose. Stress is negative beliefs about your health. Stress is overwhelm. Stress is feeling like nobody really gets the real you. Stress is pretending to be something that you're not. Stress is feeling disconnected from source. On average, we have more than 50 stress responses per day in modern culture. And every time the body is in stress response, your body's natural self-repair mechanisms are disabled. And what kills me about this is that as doctors, by not acknowledging that, by not helping you recognize that, by not identifying with you what might be activating those stress responses in your body, we might be doing the unthinkable. We might actually be killing you. We might be reducing your life expectancy, the quality of your life, and your whole lifespan. And that is not okay. What we need to reclaim is we need to reclaim the soul medicine that medicine used to have. You know, several hundred years ago, we were much better at the soul medicine part of this. We think that chronic stress is an inevitable part of our lives, but we can learn from what scientists call blue zones around the world, these parts of the world where people have a greater than average percentage of people who live to be over 100. These people know what soul medicine is. So what is the medicine that we really need? Medicine is being loved just as you are. Medicine is helping those in need. Medicine is expressing your creative genius. Medicine is always seeing the glass half full. Medicine is the unconditional love of animals. Medicine is laughing out loud. Medicine is speaking your truth. Medicine is knowing that you belong. Medicine is communing with nature. Medicine is nourishing the body with real food. Medicine is tapping into source. Medicine is being unapologetically you.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Yeah. I'm not suggesting that you won't need other medicine. Thank God for modern medicine. Thank God for modern medicine. Yeah. Over the past century, we extended our life expectancies by 30 years. 30 years. That's remarkable. Because of the advent of things like antibiotics and vaccinations and remarkable advances in pharmaceuticals and surgical interventions. Thank God for modern medicine. My husband cut two fingers off his left hand with a table saw. Yeah, so thank God for Dr. Jones, who spent 8 hours in surgery with a microscope, putting those fingers back on so that my husband has 10 fingers today. And my friend, my 42-year-old friend, just had a stroke. Thank God for TPA, the clot buster, so that several days later he was discharged from the hospital with almost no residual deficits. I'm not suggesting that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. But what I am suggesting is that those remarkable advances that we've made in modern medicine, we've taken the biochemical approach to medicine too far, and we've forgotten what it means to be true healers. And this breaks my heart. Now, I know that what I'm saying here, that you need to look at the stress in your life and that you need to get the medicine that you really need. I know that this isn't what many of you want to hear. And honestly, I was having a meltdown on the plane yesterday coming out here because I was thinking, I don't want people to misunderstand me. And this is, you know, don't kill the messenger. It's not easy to look at these parts of your life. I was thinking about this woman, Katie Smith, who I met on my book tour, and she's a young mother with brain cancer, and she just had surgery yesterday. And I'm thinking about this talk, and I'm thinking, I don't ever want Katie to think that I'm blaming her for her brain cancer. I'm not. I'm praying for Katie. And I think about my doctor, Kim, who's one of the best doctors that I know, and I know it hurts her when I criticize medicine. If I even suggest that medicine might be killing us, this breaks her heart. She has a planet-sized heart, and her intentions are so pure. And I think about Susan Matheson, who's one of the organizers here. Susan's one of the doctors in a program that I'm leading called the Whole Health Medicine Institute, where we're teaching doctors to practice this kind of medicine. These are some of the most amazing doctors on the planet. I'm not trying to throw them under the bus. What I'm saying is that, you know, I was thinking about this, and I thought, this is my tough love TEDx talk. I'm saying this because I love my profession so much that it breaks my heart what has become of us. And I love each of you so much that I can't bear to see you squander even one more day of this beautiful life that you have the opportunity to live. And I don't want to see you accepting chronic stress as a natural part of our lives. We don't have to live this way, because life can be so beautiful. I mean, imagine this. Every morning you wake up, and you're so excited about all the possibilities that lie ahead, because anything could happen. And you're surrounded by people who love and know the real you, not the masks that you put on to try to fit in, but the real you underneath. And you're living your purpose. You're finding and fulfilling your calling. You're expressing the divine spark within you. And because you are, the bills are paid, because the universe takes care of those who are living in alignment with their divine nature. You laugh often. You love often. You get laid often. Yeah, these things are good for your health. All of these things, you guys like that. I should talk about sex more. All of those things have been scientifically proven to reduce stress responses in the body and activate relaxation responses and help your body's natural self-repair mechanisms heal you. And that's what I want for you. Now, I know this is hard because I'm not just a doctor, I'm a patient. By the time I was 33 years old, I was taking 7 medications in order to stay in the game in my life. And I had such a stressful life. But I was told that those 7 medications were going to be something that I was going to have to take for the rest of my life. And I was a doctor. My doctor professors were telling me this, so I believed them. I didn't realize that what I had to do, the medicine I really needed, was to get out of the game of my life. And when I realized what I was going to have to do, I was terrified. Because it meant I had to leave my abusive marriage. And it meant I had to quit my job in medicine. And I spent 12 years training to do this work. And it meant I had to take my entire life savings and invest it in following a dream so that I could be here talking to you about things like this today. And I'm now down to half the dose of one of my medications. And this is possible for you. I would love to be able to tell you how you can have this for yourself, but unfortunately, you're going to have to write the prescription for yourself. But what I can offer is one question that I've asked many patients that has helped many people heal, and it's this. What does your body need in order to heal? Now, I know that the answer that may come up can be very frightening, and change is so scary, and uncertainty can be paralyzing. But what I've discovered on my own personal journey is that the flip side of uncertainty is the possibility of anything being able to happen. So I've discovered that if you want big miracles, you have to take big risks. And if you're looking for smaller risks, you have to be willing to accept smaller miracles. And it's okay if you're not ready to take those risks. But I encourage you to do whatever you need to do in order to, to give your body the medicine that it really needs. So I ask this of you. We are in this together. I have a dream of healing healthcare, and it's going to take a grassroots effort, you and me together. And I'm going to have to do this with all of you, empowered patients and conscious healthcare providers, uniting together to reclaim what is rightfully ours. And I want to close with a question that Mary Oliver poses. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Let yourself give yourself the medicine that you really need. Thank you.
I am Barry, it's been the voice within. Kakite, shalom, namaste, masalam. May your God go with you.
Great Spirit, I have had it. Bring me back to the nomad.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.